Welcome to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Zaltzberg, editor of the Herald Times in Bloomington, along with co-host Mary Catherine Carmichael. And today we're going to talk about hospitals and healthcare issues. Our guest is former Columbus Regional Hospital CEO Doug Leonard. He's here with us in the studio, and he now heads the Indiana Hospital and Health Association. If you have questions and comments, please phone us at 855-0811 or outside of the Bloomington calling area, which of course includes Columbus, 877-285-9348, or you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu. Doug, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Thanks for driving over. Now, where's your office now, in Indianapolis?
It's in downtown Indianapolis. Okay. This morning I hung around Columbus for a while and visited some friends at the hospital. I haven't been there for a while, so yeah. I drove over from Columbus.
All right. Well, we're glad you made the trip over.
Thank you.
Let's start out by having you explain to us what the Indiana Hospital and Health Association is.
Sure. Well, we are, I guess a generic description would be a trade association representing hospitals. We have about 130 hospitals, acute care hospitals that are members. We have about 170 members in total, and that includes other kinds of hospitals, psychiatric hospitals, community mental health centers, et cetera. And so we represent their interest in the legislature. We also provide some services to them, some data services, education, and generally try to be the voice of hospitals in Indiana.
Mm-hmm. So now you said you've been on this job for 3 months.
Three months, right? 2 days, 4 hours.
So in the first 3 months and a few days, what have you seen as the largest issues, the highest priorities for your association and for the hospitals?
Well, I think there are no real surprises. Things that concern me as a CEO at the hospital in Columbus and concern, you know, other CEOs are sort of clustered together, and they include things like the reimbursement, you know, and we use that phrase, about 60% of the care provided at most hospitals in the state are the government insurance programs of Medicare and Medicaid. Now, that'll vary. In Gary, Indiana, they'll have more Medicaid than perhaps you might have in Bloomington as a ratio. But generally speaking, hospitals are very dependent on those forms. And so a lot of our interest is trying to make sure that we're adequately reimbursed for the care provided. And a lot of your listeners might not realize that while Medicare, especially in Medicaid, are both good insurance programs for the beneficiary, for the recipient that uses that insurance to cover themselves or their families, neither of those plans actually cover the cost of providing that service at the hospital. So that puts the hospital in a position of doing what has been referred to as cost shifting, meaning covering the costs that are not paid for by those two big plans to the other payers, which includes, you know, the Anthem and SIHO and other kinds of commercial insurance plans in the country. So that tends to occupy a lot of the time of CEOs trying to make sure that the costs are covered. There's that. Then recently, I think one thing that exploded after I became president of the association was the whole property tax issue. And so that is certainly occupying the attention of legislators and the governor, et cetera, on how we're going to adequately cover that. And hospitals, most hospitals in the state are charitable, not-for-profit hospitals. Mm-hmm. And in that role, they're relieved from their communities in paying property tax for their main service. Now, most of us in hospitals also owned other properties like houses that we might use in the neighborhood for expansion in the future. And generally speaking, most hospitals leave those on the tax rolls. But the whole question of where are the communities going to get money to cover their cost of fire and police, et cetera, they're looking at all sources. And one of those is, you know, churches and hospitals and schools and those that have not paid property tax. So that's kind of a contemporary issue that sort of exploded on the scene after I took over.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would say, and, you know, Mary Catherine knows we've been doing this a long time. I've admitted, you know, many of my shortcomings on the air. But when it comes to the whole issue of health care, you know, sometimes my eyes glaze over or roll back in my head because it just seems like such a big issue and so complex. So, you know, from an Indiana hospital, I mean, obviously the Indiana hospitals are mm-hmm. one thing, and then the national healthcare scene is right. is something else. Are there strategies within the state, you know, forget about federal strategies and, you know, nationalizing healthcare and those kind of things, but are there things in the state that we need to be doing do you think to help cover citizens, make sure that people can come to the hospital, get their services, the hospitals can stay in business because they're being reimbursed heavily enough or enough?
Right.
You know, what are some of the steps that need to be taken?
Yeah, that's a, so
that's a big question.
That's a huge question, and it's a question that many are asking right now. In fact, my argument is if it wasn't for the continuing war in Iraq occupying our national attention, I think healthcare and healthcare reform would have been the number one issue in this federal election or presidential election, I should say. And you can come at it from so many angles. I mean, it from the first from the outset, when we talk about a healthcare system in this country, it's a little bit of a misnomer because it was never a system that was designed. I mean, it just erupted and it continues to erupt in new forms every day. I always told my friends in Columbus when I talk about, the greater national scene, that it was like one of those kaleidoscopes I had when I was a kid, the cardboard one with the colored rocks. And every time you twist it, you'd get a different shape. And that twisting is happening every day with new everything from new technology emerging that's, just amazing, miraculous, life-saving technology. But it comes at a huge price, and that's coming on the market every day. And we, have to ask ourselves, how much of that can we afford? Where's the sweet spot between what's really worth the investment and going to have a return in saving lives or making lives, people live out the longer life with dignity and health? And then you couple that with the what's going on in pharmacy and the, emerging new drugs, et cetera. And we, as a country, have a lot of schizophrenia about our attitude towards healthcare because we have no constitutional right for healthcare. It's not a part of our constitution, but we all assume that it is. We feel like we have a right to healthcare, and I think we should, but nobody has ever answered the question, if we have a basic fundamental right to healthcare, how are we going to create a system? How are we going to pay for it? And so, there are so many questions that come up, the increasing cost, the burden of the, we're one of the only countries in the world that still depends on an employer-based healthcare coverage plan, and that's kind of a historical anomaly. And so we have companies, that are competing internationally with their competitors from countries where their system is a tax-based system, and so the burden isn't as acute on them for the cost of carrying that. So now they're saying, well, we can't afford to continue to offer this. We have a growing number of uninsured. Many of them are working. From almost any angle, it's a complex question. And, from my standpoint, I think it goes back to that fundamental question, is do we have a right to health care in this country? And if so, what form does that take? What should that coverage be? And then how are we going to deliver that? And short of any national debate and agreement on that, I think we're still going to have a complex system that is just growing topsy.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple things come to mind, then I'm going to go to a caller. But one is, I heard Barron Hill say that over and over again in the campaign. You probably heard it too, when he said, the first issue about health care is it a right or is it a privilege?
Exactly.
I'll get back to the other issue, which is about what communities can do, absent some national health care policy, what can communities do? But I want to go to the phones first and Pat. Pat?
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead.
I had a question. Some people were talking to me just a few days ago about the fact that they really needed to get some health things done, but they could not afford anything and they have no health care. So we all wondered, how do you apply and where do you apply for Medicare or Medicaid? Well, Medicare you do, but for Medicaid, should you get on Medicaid before you get to the hospital, or does the hospital, help you fill out the papers and help you get to Medicaid?
Okay, Pat. Thank you.
Sure. Absolutely, the hospital will help. They, business office staff in every hospital are really well trained and prepared and have a real incentive to help you get the coverage that you deserve and are eligible for. So if you contact your local hospital, I'm not sure which community you're in, but talk to the business office, and they'll give you guidance and support all through that process to help you get signed up for what you're eligible for.
All right then. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call, Pat. Our phone number is 855-0811 or 877-285-9348. Or you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu. Our guest today is Doug Leonard, who is the head of the Indiana Hospital and Health Association and also the former Columbus Regional Hospital CEO.
You know, every time you get a bill from the hospital after a stay, you're always it's always a little staggering. Mm-hmm. You can never figure out, oh, my gosh, you know, where did all the money go? This is so expensive. How do you answer people who can't figure out how that bill can be so high for, say, a 24 or 48-hour stay?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a great question. And one of the things that's always complex to explain to people is that – and there was always the classic which I hope most hospitals don't do anymore, but the $10 Tylenol or the $10 yeah. aspirin. And, you know, what the best way I can explain it is that the hospital is a tremendously expensive operation. You have 24-hour availability of nurses, of doctors, et cetera. And I use the emergency room, for example, because that's often the way a lot of people engage the hospital is that someone will come in and maybe they've twisted their ankle at the softball field. They're relatively healthy and they get there and they wait and then they get an expensive bill. And one thing that they need to understand is the people that work there, the doctors, et cetera, are prepared if that person walked in having just been shot or in a terrible car accident or a heart attack or a twisted ankle. It's the same sort of system ready for whatever walks in. And so it's a very expensive way to provide care. When you look at the hospital itself, the old, you know, many years ago, people would say, gosh, I could stay in a real expensive hotel mm-hmm. and, you know, I would only pay this much and the bill cost me this much.
Well, and I'd have a lot more fun.
Yeah, maybe. It's a pretty fun place. Depends on how you define fun, I guess. But, you know, you're not paying for the room. You're paying for the 24-hour nursing care. You're paying for what could happen as well as what does happen. You know, you're paying for the fact that maybe that you're taking an aspirin as part of your drug regimen. But if suddenly we find that that's in conflict with another drug you're taking and you have an allergic reaction, then the staff is there to respond in an emergency to save your life. So you're paying not only for what you get, you're paying also for what's available in case you need it. And so every day the cost in the hospitals tends to go up by more specialized staff, more expectations, more technology, more availability. And, you know, what it's even hard to say, you know, what a hospital was 20 years ago compared to a hospital today. It's like comparing a, you know, a Model T to a Boeing 727 because it's a completely different animal and evolves every day in terms of what's covered and what's available.
Another thing that I know hospitals are doing – well, I don't know that hospitals are doing them, but communities have facilities now where people can go if they have a sore throat or you know, some kind of issue. I hear in Bloomington we call them prompt care, but I know different communities have different names for them. Is that something the Hospital Association supports or what's your take on that?
Yeah, that it's not you know, purely in the mission of the Hospital Association, but what the members of our association are the hospitals, and the hospitals are often the ones that operate these centers. In Columbus, we had what we called prompt meds, and the hospital operated them. Often they're in partnership with physicians, and sometimes they're just entrepreneurial businesses where a physician or group have started it on their own. So I think what it's not so much a question of is that one of our, you know, sort of covered members, but rather I think it's a reflection that there's a very entrepreneurial force in healthcare right now looking for alternative ways to provide care. And that's both a blessing and a curse. And this is – I'm kind of drifting into a question you didn't ask here. But the blessing is that there are many that see opportunities to provide more efficient services or faster turnaround or more availability. You know, now we have in many places in the country nurse practitioner minute clinics and Walmarts and other, you know, new experiments like that emerging. And that's sort of driven by an entrepreneurial force that says, let me get in and find a way to, you know, make some money in this. The curse part of that is that there remains the community hospitals that have the responsibility, I think, expected by the community to provide a lot of services that don't pay for themselves and to be available to anyone regardless of care or regardless of payment. And so some of these entrepreneurial forces sort of strip those profit services away from hospitals and leave them with a greater difficulty in providing that whole range of sort of safety net services to the community.
Give us an example of a something that would pay for itself for a hospital and something that would not.
Okay. An emergency department, for example, or let me use a birthing center. You know, nearly 50% of the births in Indiana are patients with Medicaid, and Medicaid tends not to cover.
Hold on. Over 50%?
Right.
Wow. That's staggering.
It is staggering, isn't it? I mean, that's a real reflection on you know, the challenge for an OBGYN specialist, for example, you know, half of their patients come from Medicaid or – and that's not even including those that come without any form of insurance. So you add that in there too, and they're the people with nothing at all that come in. So you take a service like a birthing center or an OBGYN practice, then that requires a subsidy. And a service like a radiology department where you have MRI and CT scan, et cetera, and those, I think anybody looking at their bill would say, gosh, that cost a lot. But the cost of that doesn't just cover the cost of buying and staffing that piece of equipment. It also covers a loss taken on the OBGYN service or for patients in the emergency department that can't pay for themselves, et cetera. So you lump all that together, and the typical hospital might have a modest profit margin at the end of the day, but that comes from, you know, putting four services that make money and services not make money and melding them together and ending up hopefully ahead at the end of the day so that you can keep reinvesting in the business.
I want to try to tie some of this together because, you know, you said earlier, you talked about sort of the evolution of hospitals and how they're a totally different place than they were 20 years ago, and I assume what you mean by that is that technology has been driven. They're big pieces of equipment, very expensive. And then on the other hand, there is so much more competition for community hospitals than there were 20 years ago. So how does that change the environment in which you operate? I think you probably just answered that partially.
Yeah, partially. I think competition is one of the most challenging things going on for hospitals now, because the competition comes from a number of different forces. First of all, you have other systems that are competing for the same market share. You know, you have a Clarion or a St. Vincent or St. Francis, larger systems that are spreading out around the state, and then so there's hospital-to-hospital competition. And then you add in that for-profit hospitals. I know what you're going through here in Bloomington with competing hospitals. And then probably the part that a lot of people don't see but is one of the biggest challenges for a community hospital CEO is competition with their own doctors who are looking – you know, their income may be in decline or they feel it's in decline or they may just want more income. And so they're looking at ways that they can bring new technology in their office. So an orthopedic group that might open their own hospital or might buy their own MRI machine or something. And so that is volume that may have gone to the hospital before that provided throughput and profit to support those other services that's suddenly taken out. And so that's, you know, one of the challenges that I think keeps a lot of CEOs awake these days.
Yeah. Now, the association that you're involved with, is this all not-for-profit hospitals?
No. Or? We have for-profit and not-for-profit hospitals. Okay. Both the hospitals in Bloomington, for example. Mm-hmm. Members of the association.
So you have to look out for all sides of this.
Yeah, we do.
But let's look at that radiology example of, you know, that maybe coming out of the hospital and being done by a private practice. I know it's also partly – I mean, I think the hospitals have to take some responsibility for this because mm-hmm. it's often a much more pleasant experience in a smaller
absolutely.
Setting, more, if you will, serene mm-hmm. than you know, a hospital is oftentimes kind of a hectic place and not that that much fun to go to
absolutely.
Something like that.
You know, that is the advantage that they have carved out for themselves is that they often are at a place and a location and create an ambiance and the environment that makes it much easier to use. And that's a challenge for hospitals now. And I had this conversation about an hour ago with a colleague where what I've been preaching is that I think hospitals have to start to sell our services the way people want to buy what they want to buy. Now, I always use banking as an example. You know, 20 years ago, a full-time working person couldn't use a bank. Oh. They opened at 9 o'clock. They closed at 4:30. They weren't open on Saturday. They didn't have ATM machines. They didn't have internet, et cetera. And look at the change there. And that change didn't come because they said, hey, let's go do these 50 new things. It came because people were demanding, you know, I can't get there at 8 in the morning or 9:30 in the morning. I'd like to do it at my convenience. You know, when I get my prescription filled, I go to a drugstore that's open all night because I happen to be a night owl. So at 10 o'clock, at night, I'll say, geez, I forgot to get my prescription. I'll go get it filled. You know, you walk into a Walmart in the middle of the night, which I haven't done very often, but they tell me that they're filled. Hospitals have been, and I think this is a vulnerability we have if we're going to compete well, have been a little bit lax about getting out there and selling our services, especially the outpatient diagnostic elective stuff, the way people want to buy them. So, you know, I would argue that we may look more like a shopping mall in a future than we do like a hospital today. And, you know, if you have to go to the hospital and you have to register twice and you've parked 30 doors away and you're sitting next to, you know, people that are quite ill and you think, geez, this is no fun. So, you know, if I can go and walk right in the front door, you know, at the shopping mall and get it done. So that's – and many hospitals have, you know, gotten this message and are really working. Well, I know your local hospital in Bloomington has acquired property where they're going to be doing a lot more of their outpatient services. And I think the really sort of well-designed system of the future is going to look physically a lot different than it does today.
Interesting. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right. Our phone numbers again, 855-0811 in Bloomington, 877-285-9348. Outside of the local calling area, and you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu. Our guest today, former Columbus Hospital Columbus Regional Hospital CEO, Doug Leonard, who is the head of the Indiana Hospital and Health Association. It's about break time, so I think we'll take a short break. You're listening to Noon Edition.
You're listening to Noon Edition on member-supported WFIU. Production support comes from Closets 2, providing organized and expanded closet and storage space for home office and garage, using a variety of systems with no major renovations. Closets 2 owned and operated in Bloomington, 332-2233. And from South Dunn Street Project, represented by Brian Lappin Real Estate, classic bungalow-inspired architecture in the Bryan Park neighborhood of Bloomington, www.southdunnstreet.info. WFIU will host a debate between Bloomington mayoral candidates Mark Cruzan and David Sabog. We need your questions before the program. Calls will not be taken during the show. You can submit your questions to noon@indiana.edu. Please do include your first and last name, daytime phone number, mailing address, and email address. The debate will be part of Noon Edition, WFIU's weekly public affairs call-in program, and that's Friday, September 21st at 12:06 p.m.
Welcome back to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Zaltzberg from the Herald Times, along with Mary Catherine Carmichael. And our guest today, Doug Leonard, who's the head of the Indiana Hospital and Health Association and former Columbus Regional Hospital CEO. If you have questions or comments about health care or the hospital system, please phone us at 855-0811 or 877-285-9348 or send your email to noon@indiana.edu. Now, before we get back to talking about health care and hospitals, I want to mention next week's show, which is a mayoral debate featuring Mayor Mark Cruzan of the City of Bloomington and Republican David Sabog, a city council member who's running against him in the mayoral election. We're going to have them in the studio. Mary Catherine and I will be asking them questions, and we want you to be able to weigh in with your questions too. So you can send them today or anytime this week to noon@indiana.edu.
Right. It's one of the few shows that we won't have open phone lines, so nope. You need to weigh in ahead of time.
Right. That's right.
Okay.
Okay. So we hope you'll take advantage of that.
Next week, same bat time, same bat station.
That's right. Or bat channel.
Yeah, bat channel. Well, I changed it to stations because it's radio.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
I customized it.
All right. And today we hope you'll weigh in with your questions about health care. We've had one, and we have another person waiting on the line. It's Margaret. Margaret?
Hello.
Hi, Margaret.
Hi. Would you have your guest talk about the recent news that I've read about Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements to hospitals being cut this year, starting in October, and that even bigger cuts will be made next year and the year after? How are hospitals going to cope?
Well, that's, at the outset of the show, I said that was one of the biggest issues hospitals have is, we're funding the war, we're funding other kind of national priorities. And so every year in the national budgeting process, the government looks for where they can cut. And it's a real frustration because, as I said, our costs are not covered now. And I want to make sure I distinguish what I mean by cost. I'm not talking about a profit that the hospital needs to make. I'm talking about actually the cost of paying the salaries of the nurses, paying the heat and light, et cetera, when it may cost us a dollar to provide care for a patient, and we receive maybe 65 cents back from Medicare or Medicaid. Now, that varies across the country. But so whenever there's an attempt nationally to cut further the payments to hospitals, that really frustrates us. And that's where I think in the lobbying work that we do at the association, we really try to pay attention to that. We work with the American Hospital Association to try to appeal to legislators and the administration to reverse some of those attempts to cut payments, because the net effect is something that a lot of people don't think about, the effect on economic vitality in a community. Because if we get those cuts, there is no other pocket it comes from except to charge someone else to make up for it. And the someone else, we talk about insurance companies, but who's paying for the insurance are individuals that are buying the policies, and importantly, businesses, the employers, who are paying this increasing burden of the cost. And it's a form of hidden tax that I think deserves more debate and understanding, because I think the business community really ought to rise up and have a voice on the government's unwillingness to fund the benefit that it's selling to people or providing to people, and then shifting that cost to employers and manufacturers. And so they're trying to compete internationally, and they can't afford to sell products with that kind of additional burden on them. So I really like to propose that it's a hidden tax that ends up shifted to businesses, and I think there ought to be more dialogue about that and look for new ways of financing healthcare in this country that isn't going to shift that burden to them.
All right, Margaret.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for the call. 855-0811 or 877-285-9348 or noon@indiana.edu. As I said earlier in the program, sometimes the healthcare issue is so complex to me, so I want to make sure again and have you explain this maybe even a little bit more. So you provide a service. Medicaid pays 65 cents of the dollar for the service. You have to find that 35 cents someplace else. Mm-hmm. So where is that someplace else?
Well, we did some numbers a few years ago, and I want to make sure I qualify that I'm simplifying it greatly. It's a lot more complex in terms of how we get reimbursed. And if someone from the Medicaid program is listening to me, I don't want to have them think that I'm trying to take shots, because it's a lot more complex than I make it. But generally speaking, I think that's what happens. And so we did some charts a few years ago at the Hospital Association. I had an independent study done that showed, for example, that if Medicare and Medicaid paid, let's say, 65% to 70% of our cost, then our employers paid 140% of our cost, so that they're actually carrying a lot more of the financial burden. They're paying a premium to cover the deficits that are created by these national and state programs. And so, we have a very complex, and I shudder every time I think about it, what we call a charge master at a hospital. And it, it has maybe tens of thousands of line items. And it's all an attempt to try to, at the end of the day, have enough money to at least have a modest profit so that you can keep reinvesting in the business. And so it's moving dollars around and charging charges around so that you, hopefully at the end of the day, have ended up with financial stability.
So let me make sure that I understand it, because if I can understand it, then a lot of people can. But so partially then, I mean, you're getting – your expenses are growing because of all sorts of reasons.
Right.
Medicaid's maybe they're reimbursing at the same level or maybe even a little less.
Sure.
Certainly the percentage is less. Mm-hmm. So the burden is heavier on the businesses. The mm-hmm. businesses consequently either pay their employees, that would be me, mm-hmm. pays more for my premiums mm-hmm. or the businesses maybe pay less in pay raises because they have to pay more in benefits. So it really does wind up coming out of the pocket of individuals.
It does. You know, and from a kind of a national debate, often when the administration proposes cuts in Medicare, they'll use the phrase, we're going to cut payments to providers. And that's a very, you think, well, providers get enough money. What do they need it for? But what it really comes down to is that it's cutting the amount that they'll pay us, which consequently means that somebody else is paying more. And you're right on. You're following that track a little bit that would say, well, if, I use a Cummins engine, a Cummins Inc. in Columbus, a big business, international business competing all over the world. And so their costs go up for their employment costs go up. So what are they faced with? They're either cutting other costs, they're cutting employment, or they're shifting more, and this is what's happening increasingly, they're shifting more of that healthcare cost to their employees. And some companies have had to cut benefits that they were going to provide to retirees. Some have cost, had employees pick up a greater share of the premium cost. Some have discontinued benefits altogether. And it's actually for many employers, it's kind of gut-wrenching because they want to be an employer that, provides a good, stable set of benefits for their employees and make sure that they are, that they have good life balance and coverage in all kinds of ways. And yet their financial condition doesn't permit it. And, healthcare is one of those things. There are many other forces too, but that tends to be what happens when healthcare costs go up.
Okay. We've got a phone call. We have an email. Let's go to the phone first. It's Joe. Joe?
Yes. Hey, thanks for talking about that issue. I wanted to bring up a related thing that's not covered much locally, but if you read New York Times and Wall Street Journal, it mentions a lot of these Medicare cuts are they're not going to reimburse hospitals for errors. And I wondered if you could address that
sure.
They're just simply saying, look, if you make errors, we shouldn't pay for that. The hospital should absorb that cost. And the other second part of that same question is, how can the population, your readers, be more informed about hospital errors at the local hospital, like Bloomington Hospital? How can we find out information about those kinds of things so we can make informed decisions about seeking care?
Sounds like a question for me.
Yeah, those are great questions. The part that the caller is calling about is that there is another force going on in healthcare right now is there's a desire to make sure that care provided in hospitals is as safe and error-free as possible. And there was a study several years ago by the Institute of Medicine that declared that up to 98,000 people a year died from errors in hospitals. And, whether the numbers were perfectly right or not, one unnecessary death from an error is too many. 98,000 is a national crisis. And so there's been quite a movement to try to find ways to provide assurance that care is safe and error-free, or at least errors that don't cause harm. And so one of the measures that he mentioned is that Medicare, among the things that it's doing, and it's been doing many good things to help bring attention to and provide safe care, is to say that we won't reimburse for errors that occurred. And I think as an association, we support anything that's a movement towards reducing the number of errors. If you take it out of context of everything else it has some weaknesses because it doesn't really deal with the fundamental cause of the error. It just says we're not going to pay for it. But if you put it back in the context of other things that Medicare and a lot of other agencies and hospitals are doing to reduce the potential for errors in hospitals, then it's one of a family of things that are going on.
Can I ask a follow-up to that?
Uh-huh.
If Medicare doesn't pay for it, then who does? I mean, again, the hospital has a certain amount of money. Does that just right. pass along.
Right. Well, that's the question. Okay. I think, in the greater scheme of things, when you go to a macroeconomic standpoint, then there's still a cost incurred and it's going to mm-hmm. be covered someplace. You know, I wanted to say, though, one thing that most hospitals do in this, this effort by Medicare made attention or got the media's attention. But I know as a hospital CEO, if we had an error, if we knew that we really had an error, then the first thing we did was not charge the patient for, what occurred. I mean, that tends to be the practice in most hospitals. So Medicare is kind of formalizing what would have happened otherwise. And the second part of his question is, where do you find out? And there are a lot of sources you can seek now. One, hospitalcompare.gov is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid site, and they have a number of measures that hospitals are publicly reported on that would help you know whether your hospital is doing a good job against its family measures. And there are a lot of other things out there on the internet and in the State Department of Health, et cetera, reports that are coming out to compare one hospital to another.
Yeah, I think, Joe, I think that was probably partially a question for you and partially me as the editor of the local newspaper, okay. So we'll find I'll get more information from you about
sure.
that.
Sure, be happy
we'll
to.
Move on. All right, our phone numbers again are 855-0811 or 877-285-9348, or you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu. Doug Leonard is our guest. He's the head of the Indiana Hospital and Health Association and the former Columbus Regional Hospital CEO.
Here's an email that came in. It says, you have been speaking of Medicare and Medicaid issues, but what about private insurer issues? It seems that Anthem, as I'm sure other major insurers, continues to put burdens, increased documentation, time limits, et cetera, on providers that in the end will reduce the payments they, the providers, receive from Anthem. These conditions seem to change monthly, rendering it impossible to keep up with the demands, thus reducing the payments that Anthem provides to providers. How can hospitals keep up with these changes and demands?
Go ahead.
Well, there's a follow-up, but you go ahead with that one.
Well, I was going to say I couldn't have described it better. You know, that person knows how frustrating it is that, the system we have where we're paid most of the care provided is paid for by an insurance plan of one form or another. And I have been talking about Medicare and Medicaid, but Anthem is one of what we'd call the commercial insurers, Anthem, United, SciHo locally, et cetera. And in some of those plans, it is an extreme frustration for the hospital because we're constantly negotiating how to continue to get paid for the service. And often we have a whole fleet of personnel that we pay to sit on the phone and call these plans to get justification or get approval for providing the service. And hospitals, and this is the thing, the whole administrative burden in hospitals to get approvals, to get paid, to have all the administrative stuff do, that just takes money away that should be at the bedside with patients. And so that's a real challenge. I know there's a second part to the question.
Yeah, I just had to chuckle at your gift for understatement. Further, how would a single-payer system affect hospitals?
Well, a single-payer system is one that's getting a lot of attention nationally now as a discussion of, is that a way to try to reduce cost and simplify? And that probably relates
to – Can you define that?
Oh, sure. Right now, a payer, and the term we use as payer is an insurance plan or – Medicare, Medicaid, others, and the commercial insurers and such. And the concept of single-payer system is typically a government program where everybody is under the same insurance plan. And it takes various forms in other countries. You might have a basic plan provided by the government, such as in Canada, and then that's supplemented by private plans if people want to buy additional kinds of coverage. But it's being debated now partially in response to the concern about 45 million and plus Americans that have no health insurance. And often they're the working poor, their employer doesn't provide it, et cetera. And so people are saying this is a national embarrassment to have this, that so many people are out there without coverage. So is there a new design, a new commitment to coverage where we could say let's have the government or a form of a plan for everyone to provide at least a basic level of health care? And you put that then in the whole concept or the whole context of our right to health care and how we're going to finance it and what's the role of the government, et cetera.
Okay. And I can't let you get off the show without asking your reaction to Michael Moore's movie Sicko.
I'm embarrassed to say I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, my gosh.
I live in Columbus, and we don't have access to all the films that are coming out there, so I'm waiting to see it. I'd probably be remiss commenting on it, but I understand that it's a lot about that particular question.
It is.
It's about access and how we ensure and whether people have a right to it, et cetera. So I'm anxious to see it, so I won't be a movie reviewer today.
Okay.
I did see some good films last week, if you want to know that.
Right. We'll talk after the show.
All right.
We have another phone caller, and it's Jim. Jim?
Hello.
Hello, Jim.
Hi. This kind of goes along with the one-payer comment that was just made about. I hear a lot of the arguments against the one-payer system as, oh, you'll wait in lines, the care will be of a lower quality and that sort of thing. But from personal experience, having used healthcare in foreign countries that have one-payer systems, the waits, and this is not just because I'm a foreigner, because I watch the everyday people that are there, are much shorter than any doctor's office I've ever been to in this country. I can have an appointment, say, for 10 a.m. and then have to wait until 11:30 to get in. There, it's about 15 minutes at the most. And second of all, there's the concept of financing this. If they pass some kind of a constitutional amendment or something of that sort that created this fund and prevented Congress from raiding it like they do Social Security all the time, then there would actually be surpluses in Social Security if they weren't constantly sapping money off of that. So, and things like Medicare would be fully funded. But just wanted to kind of get your perception on these things.
Sure. He brings up a really good point, because often the debate about a single-payer system tends to be fraught with myth and misconception about what it's really like in other countries. I mean, you hear in Canada that the wait time for, a total hip replacement might be, 6 months, 9 months, et cetera, where I could get that today in the U.S. And, I don't know how often that's true or if it's basically true. But you also hear that in other countries, and Canada's a good example, where when you poll the people about their satisfaction with the healthcare system, nationally they're generally pretty proud of it and they're happy with it. So now please don't take either of those comments as a summary of how it really works in Canada, because I'm just saying that the debate has I think needs to be informed by fact about what's going on in other countries, because I hear in some countries where they have a tax based single payer system that they don't have wait times and that things work very well. So I think that you're hitting right on the crux of how we're going to have to address this issue nationally, is let's get facts in about how it works or doesn't work. And you also made a very good point too about, if we're going to have this, if we say that healthcare is a right and we're going to fund it, then let's be honest about what it's going to cost us to fund it, and then let's secure that so that we aren't offering a government promise that's unfulfilled.
Right. And one more thing on the cost aspect is I just had a procedure here in the States, and I got the bill for that. Now, the hospital charged $2,500 for that, and the insurance allowed was $500, and that's, of course, what the insurance paid. And then, so if you're uninsured in this country, you're actually getting charged five times more than what the insurance. That seems to me to be quite an unfair system, where you charge somebody five times more than what you charge the insurance company. It should be just a one price thing that everybody.
Yeah, well, I think, part of the problem in your presentation there is that the insurance company said what the value of this is, and that's not necessarily true. The charge often has has not a real explainable relationship to the cost of the service because of all the things I said earlier. But that's one answer. The other is that every hospital in the country, I believe now, and there may be some that are exceptions, but I doubt it, has recognized that there was a time when people without insurance were actually being charged the full charge, and now nearly every hospital that I know of has developed discount programs for the uninsured so that they're not disadvantaged by not being part of a purchasing plan like an insurance company, negotiates with a hospital. So it's not as simple as the insurance company says that it's only worth one-fifth of what the charge was, because that's their determination, and we don't always agree with those.
All right, Jim. Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. That's part of the whole complexity of being a patient, a consumer, because I know when I get health care bills, it'll say, here's the charge, here's the discount, here's what the insurance company says it is, and then you pay this.
Right.
So I just get my checkbook out and
pay whatever it is. One of the biggest challenges, I think, for people, and this is the hospital too, is coming up with a bill that makes sense, that's simple to understand, and it's the way we're paid that has created this system that's almost indecipherable anymore. And, I think if I could wave my magic wand and try to fix the system, I would say, let us design care the way it's supposed to be designed, safe, doing only the things that need to be done at the right time in the right place without disruption to the patients, and then pay us for that. And, we would find, I think, and give people access. So I think we'd find if we could, wave a magic wand and simplify our world, that's going to be the solution. Provide care that's supposed to be provided when it is, no more than should be, no less. Make sure it's reliable and accurate. And then, design systems to pay the hospitals and the doctors for that care. No more, no less than, what's necessary for that. And now, how do we go from this bizarre, complex system we have to that? That's a conundrum that'll keep me employed for a number of years and many other people.
I think if I could wave my magic wand, I'd just make you Secretary of Health or whatever. Put it in your hands.
Yeah, we'd really start going down from there.
Here's another question. The overriding question of today is, who pays the difference of what Medicare and Medicaid pays and what the real cost is to hospitals? How do the private insurers come off so blamelessly? The answer to who pays is the difference between The answer to who pays the difference is those of us who pay for health insurance. This includes businesses and individuals who are insured too. Our premiums continue to rise and your reimbursements continue to be cut. But the blame Put the blame where the blame is due. My guess is that the hospitals of Indiana do not see the profit margin that WellPoint/Anthem does.
Any response to that?
You want to get out your 10-foot pole for this one?
No, I couldn't have said it better. Yeah. I mean, I think a big question is, and I'm sure my colleagues at the insurance companies would like to hit me with a 10-foot pole now, but, I think we ought to ask ourselves, is that additional profit, the sometimes egregious profits, I think, really contributing to the well-being of the citizens of the United States, or is it an unnecessary layer? So I think when, many doctors are seeing their income go down, when, hospitals are struggling to try to get all of the costs met. Now, I'm not saying we're without fault either, so don't, that's a whole other show, I think. But and then you see, these enormous incomes going to the insurance plans, you have to ask, is that really the best use of that money that should go to the care at the bedside? I'm a hospital operator by training, and I care about care at the bedside. That's where all of our focus should be. That's our mission. That's why we have these jobs, and everything ought to emanate from that. So if it doesn't contribute to making that patient safer and that nurse at 2 in the morning having what she needs to take care of that patient in a safe way, then I think we ought to question whether it's adding anything.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have two calls we're going to try to get to before the end of the show. Andy is first. Andy?
Hi, how are we doing?
Good.
Very quickly, maybe it's a comment, maybe it's a question. I just want to get your comment on this. It seems to me, in talking with some of my brothers and sisters that are in the healthcare field, they're always talking about the fact that this country really has a problem with preventive medicine, preventive maintenance medicine, and the fact that a lot more money could be spent on that, and in line of that would bring down some of the health care problems that we have as far as costs at hospitals, costs at for procedures that are very high priced, which could have been prevented at that point. And it just seems to me, as a country, we've really gotten away from the preventive maintenance side of this thing, and are more reactionatory in our services or healthcare services. So I just wanted to get your comment on that.
Quick comment?
Sure. I can tell you that if you talk to primary care doctors, which, you know, typically are family practitioners, OBGYNs, internists, et cetera, that they'll tell you how frustrated they are that the service they provide, which is, you know, the basic primary care services, are not valued as highly as some of the procedural services that other specialties have. And we, you know, our system tends to value those things more. And I couldn't agree with you more that, you know, as we look for national solutions on this, you start with a real fundamental pieces. You know, you start with childhood immunizations. You start with keeping people healthy instead of fixing them when they get sick. You know, we get paid at a hospital for doing an amputation on a foot or a toe of a diabetic patient, but there isn't a payment in the system for us to go out and make sure that that person has good-fitting shoes, that they're keeping their insulin in order, et cetera. So, you know, we're going to have to reorder our priorities, I think, just the way you described.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Andy.
And thank you.
We're going to go back to the phones. And as predicted, Dr. Rob Stone.
Good.
Rob, we predicted you'd be here today.
Well, I'm a little slow getting on board, but I guess I'm maybe getting the last word.
You are. We've got about a minute to go.
Okay. So my question is very brief. I'm a physician, and what I'd like to know is what's the best way that we can really help build the political will to move this country towards a Medicare for all single-payer type system?
Sure. I think, and I know about Dr. Stone, he's one of my, heroes that is doing, you know, is really at the forefront of calling attention to this question, doing great things in Bloomington and elsewhere to try to, you know, deal with the uninsured and find ways to provide for them. And I think you mentioned the word political will. I think the more we have grassroots support calling for reforms in the system that will do the things that we've described today, I think the more power we amass that way, the better off we are. And so you know those avenues yourself on how to use it. And I think by continuing to make those calls and drawing others into your army, I think, mm-hmm. you know, we'll make more progress.
All right, Rob, any final word?
Well, I just appreciate all the word we can get out. It's an important issue, and everybody needs to get involved.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Talk to you again. All right. And we are about out of time. I want to thank our guest today, Doug Leonard, who's with the Indiana Hospital and Health Association. I want to remind you about next week's show, which is the two candidates for mayor of Bloomington. If you have questions for them, please send them in to noon@indiana.edu. For Mary Catherine Carmichael, producer Catherine Hageman, and engineer Mike Pashkash, I'm Bob Salzberg. Thanks for listening.
Noon Edition is a production of WFIU and the Herald Times. A podcast of this and other WFIU programs is available at wfiu.org.